Okay, Marie. Marie, since you're standing, grab that microphone behind you. Just stand behind that microphone. Go ahead, stand behind the microphone. Don't give me those nasty looks.
What?
Tell me. Tell me, are you going to sing? And dance? No, I don't want you to have that. No. No! Woman?
Ex nihilo.
Take those papers and put it back there. I'm going to give you an assignment. Put the papers down. Show respect for the teacher. Just go stand behind the microphone. It's really easy.
Oh my gosh.
Did your boys cause you any trouble growing up? I wonder where they got it.
Yeah, it came from Joey.
Apparently not. We just saw a manifestation of it here. Tell me one thing you learned last session that spoke to you, that was helpful.
That it's possible to know many Bible stories but miss the Bible story.
That's excellent. And why is that important to you? Why did that stand out to you?
Because that is the reason why, that is the root of salvation, is the Bible story.
Yeah, excellent.
So that's why there are people who may know parts about the Bible but aren't saved because they don't know the story of salvation.
Wow, beautiful. Well done. All right. Okay, I need a representative from table 30. The nice lady with that orange, whatever that is. Please stand. What do you call that? A poncho or a wrap or a what? A blanket. Okay, yeah, good. You wear colors like that. See, I can spot you. But it's covering up your name. Let me see your name tag.
Lorely. It's Lorely.
Lorely?
Yeah.
Lorely. Okay, tell me one thing. What stood out to you in the last session?
It's interesting to finally discover how to ask the right questions. Have been asking God, what's your message for me as I read the Bible? And it's very enlightening and mind-renewing today to realize that the first thing it takes is for me to understand the audience of the Bible first or the book.
Yeah.
Before I start asking how it relates to me.
Really great. Yeah. Excellent. Thank you very much. You did such a good job. Good. Okay, let's go over here. I need table 10. Table 10 right there. And that fuchsia color right there. The girl who's not looking at me. We call that fuchsia. Yeah, fuchsia. Go ahead, stand in front of that microphone right there. Fuchsia with that nice sort of, what do you call that thing? Like a shawl or a... The microphone's over there, honey. Stand right behind that microphone. Do you want me to escort you? Just walk right over there. Yeah, you might have to bring it down a little bit there.
Yeah, good morning. Hi,
how are you doing?
This
is not a group question, okay? This is you.
I learned about our relationship as with God and how we can relate to other people through our relationship with God.
Wow, you learned that last session, huh? Excellent. I didn't know I taught that. That's pretty good. Thank you. Okay, I need one last one. Some ladies have hidden the table number so that I can't see it. I'm looking at that table right there. They just put their number down. They set it down. Table 26. That was evil. Okay, I need the lady with that multicolored sort of, all sorts of things happening. There's like a deep pink sort of color and some gold in there. Yes, there are microphones right by you. Tell me the most important thing you learned.
I don't know if it was mentioned, but the Bible is not written to us, but for us. And it's basically Christological.
It is. Wow, nice use of a good word there. Go back to the microphone. Go back to the microphone. Explain Christological. What does that mean?
Christ-centered.
Yes. Christ-centered. Yeah. Beautiful, beautiful, beautiful. Okay, let's go back to, we're on the fall. Everybody ready for some more? Okay. Time for me to talk now, table 26. The fall is introduced in Genesis chapter 3 and expanded through chapter 11. Now, in those chapters, those nine chapters, there are hints of redemption. Hints of redemption. But primarily, the purpose of those chapters is to show the extent and the depth of sin. That's what chapter 3 through 11 is about. And when you read that section, you see that Moses goes to great lengths to highlight just how sinful sin really is. And this is essential, you see, to understand redemption. Until we know the magnitude of our debt, we can never really know the greatness of His provision. So another way to say it is, if the bad news isn't that bad, then the good news isn't really that good. Or another way to say it, and this would make me popular in Tennessee, the badder the bad news is, the gooder the good news is. And so you see, right here at the outset, we get this terrible picture of human depravity to show us how deeply sinful we are, how great the fall really was. This quote from David Klein says, "There is an ever-growing avalanche of sin, a continually widening chasm between man and God. There is a movement from disobedience in the garden to murder, Cain and Abel, to reckless killing with Lamech, to titanic lust, multiple wives, to total corruption and violence, and finally to the full disruption of humanity." So you see, we see this ever deepening chasm of sin. Sin escalates, it multiplies. It gets worse and worse. Number one, without any introduction, an evil personality in the guise of a serpent appears in the narrative to incite rebellion in the heart of Adam and Eve. He attacks God's truthfulness, authority, and goodness. See, he's got three strategies. And those strategies, he's still using them today. Three strategies. So the first one is, he says, has God said? Right? Now, what does that strategy challenge? God's truthfulness. Yeah. Has God really said? Is he really telling the truth? Can he be depended on? Aren't there some errors and mistakes in the Bible? Can we really believe in these things? Has God said? The next strategy, you see, he says, you will surely not die. What is he challenging there? I've already given you the answer. It's in that nice little line there. So, authority, yes, how brilliant you are as students. Challenging God's authority, right? God's authority to execute judgment. Certainly God won't cause you to die just for eating a tree. And the third strategy says, for God knows your eyes will be open. You see, he's holding out on you. He's keeping something back from you. He knows if you get a hold of this, good things will happen. Did I lose my power? For the whole time? Gone. Now it's back. Testing 1, 2. Testing 1, 2, 3. Give me power, Lord. Okay. Did it just go out or had it been going for a while? Just now. Good. Okay. So God's holding out on you, right? This statement challenged God's goodness. Now, every lie that he tells us today is one of those strategies. He's attacking God's truthfulness, his authority, or his goodness. He just doesn't have any new tricks. He just has different wrapping, different packaging. But it's the same strategies over and over. Beginning then with Cain and Abel, two lines of humanity emerged within human history. On one side was the seed of the serpent, and on the other side was the seed of the righteous, who would prepare the way for the coming Messiah, the promised seed, capital S. You see, so Cain's rebellion perpetuates a line of humanity who would walk in the rebellious ways of the serpent. That's why we see in the book of Jude chapter 1, well, only one chapter, but verse 11, Jude says, "Woe to them," talking about some people that had come into the church at that time, "they have taken the way of Cain." See, all fallen humanity is the seed of Cain. They've taken his way. Two lines, two genealogical trees begin to emerge. One is the seed of the serpent. The other is the righteous seed, where the promise is being passed down to. So the godly line is passed down. Of course, Abel's dead, so it's passed down through his brother Seth, who took the place of Abel. And so we see two lines that are beginning to develop. And that's why when we come to the end of this section, chapter 11, what we realize is that the righteous seed is come to an end. Abraham is the last one. And he can't have children. It looks like the righteous seed has failed. And sin will overwhelm the world. That's what makes chapter 12. There's a change, you see. But God called Abraham out. The beginning of redemption takes place there. So we see these two seeds beginning to emerge. The godly seed and the righteous seed. And they'll wage war all throughout eternity down to the final battle until Christ returns. The seed of the serpent is still here in this world, and the seed of Christ, the seed of the righteous. And those two seeds, the city of God and the city of man, are in a constant war with one another. And that war will never end until the last trumpet and Christ returns, the new Jerusalem, new heavens, and the new earth. The wicked seed will be put away forever, and the righteous seed will shine for eternity. But it begins here, this battle between the two seeds. Number three, the wickedness of man increases to the point where God must bring judgment on fallen humanity through the flood. Now, this is one of the saddest passages in the entire Bible, and also one of the clearest expressions of the human heart. Notice Genesis 6. The Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every intention of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. Can you have a clearer description of human depravity? Every intention, that's every motive of the thought of the heart, was only evil continually. Now, you know what that's a picture of? That's a picture of my heart. And that's a picture of your heart. apart from Christ. That's what we are. And the Lord regretted or was grieved that he'd made man on earth. It grieved him to his heart. So the Lord said, I will blot out man whom I have created from the face of the land. Man and animals and creeping things and birds of the heavens, for I am sorry that I have made them. You see, when Moses writes these words, the Lord saw how great man's wickedness on the earth had become. It's an allusion, a reference back to the creation account in chapter 1. Remember, chapter 1 says, and God saw all that he had made, and it was very good. Now God sees, and it's become very evil. You see, so we see the flood is a reversal of the creation because of man's sin. The author uses the exact same grammatical structure that he used in Genesis right here to show how bad the situation had become. Everything that God had done in creation has now been reversed because of the depth of man's depravity and sin. And the only solution is he's got to wipe us out and start all over again. So not only is this one of the Bible's clearest expression of the wickedness of our heart, it's also one of the Bible's clearest expression of God's heart. Because here we see he was deeply grieved. Deeply grieved. When you examine that word, and when you see that word used by other authors in the Old Testament, it means a deep, unfulfilled longing and bitter anguish. It's compared with the grief that a young wife would feel if her husband betrayed her, left her for another woman. It's also described as the grief that a woman would feel if she lost a young child. It's a deep, bitter emotion. And we see a glimpse into God's heart as he looks at man's sin. He's deeply hurt, grieved, bitter anguish in his heart at what sin has done to his creation. Now, first subpoint, the flood brings universal judgment, but it doesn't solve man's universal problem. It brings judgment, but it doesn't solve the problem. Notice what God says after the flood, after everybody but Noah and his family have been wiped out. Here's what he says: I will never again curse the ground because of man, for the intention of man's heart is evil from his youth. It brings universal judgment, but it doesn't solve our problem. You see, in the preface to the flood account, man is described as wicked, the intents of his heart continually evil. After the flood, the same portrait is painted. The flood has not altered man's basic nature. Now, if you were to ask your children, especially if you had younger Sunday school age children, what went into the ark with Noah? What would they say? Huh? The animals. But I'm asking you, what else went into the ark with Noah? Sin. Sin went into the ark. There was more than just animals that went in. Because when Adam and his family went in, sin survived and carried on, just like the animals survived and carried on. You see how horrendous sin is? That something as cataclysmic as the judgment of a flood. And can you imagine, they watch the terror of people. And yet something as terrible as that is not enough to change the human heart. You see how wicked, how desperate we are, that even a universal flood can't change our own nature, our heart. You see, the purpose of the Old Testament, it's leading up to the solution. It's eliminating any possible answer that we could come up with that would solve our problem. There's no alternative but Christ. Even a universal flood can't do it. You see, the very next narrative after the flood, we have this terrible narrative of the violence. God has to wipe everybody out. But then the very next narrative is, we see one of the darkest stories of Noah's drunkenness and Ham's rebellion. Noah's story began with the testimony of his righteousness, but it ended with him in a degraded condition, drunk on the floor. The character deterioration is consistent with the theme of this portion of Genesis. As a matter of fact, people who study the Bible, a lot of people study the Bible who don't know God, but people who study the Bible who don't know God think that because Noah acted so differently before the flood that after, that they've suggested there's two different Noahs, two different people being talked about. But you see, they don't understand how sinful sin is. You see, here's the man who once watched in righteousness over a wicked world, now planting a vineyard, getting drunk and naked in his tent. So we see the flood as a reversal of the creation account. Remember, in creation, God plants a garden for man to enjoy. After the flood, man plants a vineyard so he can get drunk. In the creation, Adam ate the fruit and became naked, or became aware of his nakedness. In the flood, Noah ate the fruit of his orchard and became literally naked. The point that we get here is the same cycle of sin is continuing, even after the awesome revelation of judgment. The message, even the fiercest judgment, cannot change or subdue the wickedness of the human heart. It's going to take something else. What that is, the story doesn't tell us at this point. Like all good stories, it's producing tension. We're wondering, if that won't change us, if that won't answer our need, what could possibly answer the need? And that's what the Old Testament keeps asking, that question, without ever giving us the full answer. We need the New Testament for the answer. The chronicle of man's sin and rebellion reached a new low in the narrative of the Tower of Babel. The tower builders rebelled against God's command to fill the earth and rejected God's sovereign right to rule their life. Genesis 11. Now the whole earth had one language and the same words. And as people migrated to the east, they found a plain in the land of Shinar and they settled there. And they said to one another, come, let us make bricks and burn them thoroughly. And they had brick for stone and bitumen for mortar. And they said, come, let us build ourselves a city and a tower with its top in the heavens, and let us make a name for ourselves. Notice that language there, because we're going to see that same language repeated in chapter 12. They said, let us make a name for ourselves, lest we be dispersed over the face of the earth. You see, this man's arrogant attempt to seize control of his own destiny. God said, fill the earth, but they chose to make a name for themselves. Moses refers to the tower builders as the children of men. In an obvious insult, towards their childish attempt to make a name for themselves. This section ends with the finality of judgment. All the previous stories in Genesis 3 through 11 have some element of God's grace. When you go back and you look through the stories, as bad as we see the fall, there's a little hint. So there's a promise in Genesis chapter 3 of a righteous seed that's coming. In the next chapter, we see God making garments of skin. Obviously, an animal is being slain and his blood's being poured out. We see little glimpses all throughout the story, little pictures, little hope of the possibility of redemption. But chapter 11 is noticeable that there's no hint of a positive hope, of the potential for revelation. It's just the finality of judgment. In the final narrative of the city and tower called Babel, there is no grace. Gerhard von Rad said, "The whole primeval history seems to break off in shrill dissonance. And we now ask the question even more urgently, is God's relationship to the nations now finally broken? Is God's gracious forbearance now exhausted? Has God rejected the nations in wrath forever?" Christopher Wright, in the next section of Redemption, "The whole Bible could be portrayed as a very, very long answer to a very simple question. What can God do about the sin and rebellion of the human race? Genesis 12 through Revelation 22 is God's answer to the question posed by the bleak narrative of Genesis 3 through 11. Point number one, before God declared the judgment against Adam and Eve, we'll go back and look at some of the little thoughts of redemption. Before God declared the judgment against Adam and Eve for their rebellion, he promised them ultimate victory in his judgment against the serpent. Now this is significant. Notice the order. The first thing that God says is, "I will put enmity between you," talking to the serpent, talking to really the evil personality behind the serpent, "and between your offspring and his offspring, and he," singular, not offspring, not man, but the seed, capital S, the offspring, the seed, "he will bruise your head, although you bruise his heel." His heel is part of his body, you see. So the serpent bruises the body of Christ, us, but Christ, the seed, crushes his head once and for all. You see, this is the first... Are you ready for a nice new word? Eschatological. Wow, isn't that impressive? Eschatological. Maybe you've heard the word eschatology. Eschatological refers to looking to the end. Eschatology isn't about 666 and when will Jesus return. Eschatology is the whole narrative of the Bible looking forward to God's ultimate end results. And this is the first statement of eschatology in the Bible. It's God looking to the end. God is already talking about the end here in the beginning. This hope is introduced in the Old Testament as the anticipation of Yahweh, either in his own person or in the person of a representative, a Messiah, which will one day intervene in human history for the purpose of saving his people and destroying his enemies. Now, this has been called another nice word for you, proto-evangelium. Proto-evangelium throughout church history, or literally the first glimmer of the gospel. This is a great picture of grace because the initiative is all God's. He said, "I will put," and the outcome is assured. He, Christ, shall bruise your head. This is why Paul could say with such confidence, the God of peace will soon crush Satan under your head. It's significant that God gives this promise of grace to Adam and Eve before he gives his word of judgment. Grace is first. The promise is first. Now, one of the most remarkable events in all of human history occurred when God called Abraham out of idolatry and initiated a relationship with him. You see, when we set up the story behind this calling, it's so phenomenal. We see this picture of man's sin getting greater and greater, God's heart so grieved. And we see the righteous seed, chapter 11, has come to an end. Abraham is the last one, and he's an idolater. He worships the God of the moon. All knowledge of God is gone from the earth. And Abraham, who was the last hope, is childless. And it looks like the story is coming to an end before it even gets started. But in the midst of that bleak picture of despair, God intervenes. And he calls out this idolater. Now the Lord said to Abram, go from your country and your kindred and your father's house to the land which I will show you, and I will make of you a great nation. And I will bless you and make your name great. You see the obvious corollary with the Tower of Babel. The seed of man trying to make his own name great. And the righteous seed, God making his name great. You will be a blessing, and I will bless those who bless you. And him who honors you, I will curse. And in you, all the families of the earth shall be blessed. You see, when God goes about to fix the problem caused by man's sin, he doesn't start with a big crusade. He doesn't start with some kind of universal manifestation of himself. He picks out a man, a family, and he calls a family. And he begins to work in that family. And from that family, the idea is that that family would grow and multiply generation after generation. The blessing and prosperity of God would be so evident on that family that the seed of the serpent would be provoked to jealousy. And eventually that righteous seed would grow and expand and fill all the earth. You see, that's God's heartbeat. That's the passion all throughout the Old Testament, that his people would live under this covenant that he made with them, that God could pour out his blessings upon his people, that his people would be lifted up and exalted above all the nations, that all the nations would stream to the house of God and learn of his ways, that his glory could fill the whole earth through this people. And over again, the sad story of God's people turning away and breaking his heart over and over again. To the point where his people, instead of being the glory of the whole earth, became a curse and a byword and a taunt among the nations and had to ultimately be judged and brought into captivity. That's God's plan from the beginning, and it's never changed. The family would grow and grow until it fills the whole earth. It's not the family, the natural family of Abraham now. It's the spiritual seed of Christ, the family of God, living according to his covenant promises, so he pours out his blessing upon us, so we look different than the world. And the world says, I've got to have what you have. That's the story of redemption. The remainder of Genesis is the story of God advancing his kingdom purpose of covenant relations through the family of Abraham. Okay, primary theme. We need to try to get out of Genesis here. It's taken longer than 15 minutes on Genesis, hasn't it? God placed man, male and female, in the garden and began a relationship with him. Eden was supposed to be a cosmic temple where his people would worship him and see his glory. John Salehammer says, an important detail in the description of the Garden of Eden in chapter 2 is the close similarity between the appearance and role of the garden and the tabernacle in Exodus 25 through 27. In describing the garden, the author's primary interest lay in stressing the beauty of the gold and the precious stones throughout the lands encompassed by the garden. The point of this description of the garden is to show the glory of God's presence to the beauty of his physical surrounding. You see, Eden was to be a temple. And by a temple, we mean this is the place where God dwells. And we see this theme, this motif of the temple. Isn't it interesting that the opening chapters of the story of man begin in a temple? And they end, the final chapters end in a temple. Only now we've become the temple of God. And this earth has now fulfilled the original intention of Eden. The earth becomes a gigantic temple filled with his beauty, where his presence fills all things. So this temple theme shows up all the way through Scripture, because temple is the essence. That's where you have a relationship with the deity. That's where God enters into a relationship with us. From the very beginning, his whole purpose, his whole story is about relationship. Now, God's original plan has been marred by sin, but he hasn't changed his original purpose. One way God's relationship to man was to be experienced was in the marriage union. That's why Genesis 2 says, the Lord said, it's not good for man should be alone. I will make him a helper suitable, fit for him. Seven times in the previous chapter, the author used some version of the phrase, and God saw it was good. The final time he added the adjective very to the phrase. This is significant. Everything about creation was good, but there was something that was not good. There was something missing in paradise. That's fascinating, isn't it? Man was actually lonely in paradise. And this is before sin. And so God comes along. But for Adam, there was not found a helper fit for him. So the Lord caused a deep sleep to fall upon the man. And while he slept, took one of his ribs and closed up its place with flesh. And the rib that the Lord had taken from the man, he made into a woman and brought her to the man. Then the man said, "This at last is bone of my bone and flesh of my flesh. And she shall be called woman, for she was taken out of man. Therefore a man shall leave his father and mother, hold fast to his wife, and they shall become one flesh. And the man and his wife were both naked and were not ashamed." There's a principle we'll see in Bible narrative. It's called first speech. The first time a character speaks is significant. This is the first time we hear Adam talking. And his first speech is actually not prose, it's poetry, it's a song. The first time man spoke, he sang a song, a love song to a woman. There's good indication in this that in the garden before sin, all of Adam and Eve's communication was all singing. It was like a beautiful musical. They just sang to one another. What a great picture that is. Everything about this passage is designed to tell us that the marriage relationship is the highest form of relationship. It is the highest relationship because it's the relationship we can experience God the most. And why? Because of this phrase, they were naked and not ashamed. This refers obviously to the physical quality. They didn't actually have clothes on. But they, of course, would have put clothes on eventually, because when the kids come around, it's really awkward. You got to put some clothes on for the kids' sake, right? It refers more to just clothes. It talked about a transparency and a vulnerability. See, marriage is the highest form because in marriage, you get exposed like no other relationship. It's ultimate discipleship. Only your wife, only your husband knows the real you, or at least as close as anybody gets in this life. But sin resulted in relational breakdown. Relational breakdown. The man said, "The woman you gave to be with me, she gave me fruit of the tree, and I ate it." Wow, do you see the power of sin? In the narrative just prior to this, Adam is singing a love song to his beloved. Now, he throws her under the bus. Relational breakdown because of sin. And we see this recounted in Genesis 3. To the woman he said, "I will surely multiply your pain in childbearing. In pain you shall bring forth children. Your desire shall be for your husband, and he shall rule over you." The woman's desire was to contend with her husband for leadership in their relationship. Quote from a Bible scholar, and I was careful to make sure I got a female Bible scholar. Susan is a woman. She says, and she's a very reputable Bible scholar, the words in Genesis 3:16 mark the beginning of the battle of the sexes. As a result of the fall, man no longer rules easily. He must fight for his headship. Sin has corrupted both the willing submission of the wife and the loving headship of the husband. The woman's desire is to control her husband, to usurp his divinely appointed headship, and he must master her if he can. So the rule of love founded in paradise is replaced by struggle, tyranny, and domination. And this becomes the history of mankind, doesn't it? Right there. See, so to love and to cherish becomes to desire and to dominate. That's the fight. God expressed his desire for relationship in the covenants he made with people. A covenant is an unbreakable relationship initiated by God, sealed in blood, and ratified by an oath. Wow, this is too much material. How am I going to cover all this? You guys are making this so hard on me. Let me see. I would feel so good about myself if I could finish Genesis before lunch without cheating you. So we won't read that passage, but Abraham, this is Abraham's first recorded dialogue, his first speech with God. The first time he speaks, he's filled with doubt. And what a great picture of man with all our many doubts and questions and fears. And so what's God's answer to man's doubt? God responded to Abraham's unbelief by initiating a covenant with him. Isn't it nice to know that when we have questions and doubts and fears, I was ministering to a friend of mine not long ago. Been in ministry for a long time. And yet he's been through such a terrible situation in his life. He said, I've been asking myself the question, is there even a God? He said, isn't that terrible? I said, no. That's just the nature of our fallenness. And God's answer when we have those kind of questions to our unbelief is covenant that He entered into with us. God's response to Abraham, unbelief, initiated a covenant. Starts in Genesis 12, expands in Genesis 15. We won't read this passage because I just don't have time. But a few thoughts. First of all, it's important that we see Adam sleeps while God works. Adam sleeps while God works. Why is that important? Why is that a picture? That's grace. You see, in the work of salvation, we don't contribute anything. Abraham is sleeping. God's doing all the work. Our response, our part, is just total passivity and just acceptance of what God does. Salvation is of the Lord. Now, the symbolism of this rite was clear. You see what they understood in the ancient Near East. You take an animal, and we got some big animals here, okay? A big cow, right? And you cut a cow open. Now, I was raised in the city, not the farm. I don't know anything about that, but I can picture it. Cutting open an animal that you just killed, it's going to be messy, right? You've got two parts of the animal, and there's this massive pool of blood and entrails, right? Cow innards just spilling out. And the smell must just be atrocious. And you have to walk. What happens in a covenant between a suzerain, between a ruler and a vassal, is the vassal walks through. And what he's saying, he's pledging himself to the suzerain. The suzerain, the sovereign, says, I will protect you, but if you break my rules, what we did to that ox will be done to you. Now, first of all, it's a very visceral experience. You know what the word visceral means? It's not cerebral. It's not of the head. This is something you experience in the gut. You don't forget that. The smell, the sloshing organs and blood that you walk through. It's a very memorable encounter. And what it means is that if I break the law, what we did to that cow should be done to me. But you see, in the normal treaty, it's the vassal he walks through, not the suzerain. But in this treaty, notice what happens. Abraham sleeps. God passes through. Symbolically, smoking oven. That's a picture of God. God says. So you know what he's doing? He's binding himself under an oath, saying, Abraham, when you break my commandments in my covenant, I will not exercise my right and cut you in two. But I will pass through. And if I break my promises to you, then you can do to me what was done to this cow. It's God taking the complete initiative and saying, I will fulfill my promises. That's why Hebrews chapter 6 says that God pledged two things. It's impossible for him to lie. We got his word and we've got his covenant. And that is God's answer to our unbelief.